I am super excited about this because I get to hit the gong. So.
Well done.
Hello and welcome to the City Club of Cleveland, where we are devoted to conversations of consequence that help democracy thrive. It's Wednesday, April 3rd, and myself, Golnar Farasta, Managing Director of the LGBT Community Center of Greater Cleveland and the moderator for today's forum. We are at the Happy Dog in Gordon Square for the City Club's monthly Takes On series, and tonight we are taking on Empowering Our Refugees. In the United States, more than 60,000 refugees arrived in 2023, outpacing the prior 2 years. In January of this year, the greatest number admitted were arriving from nations like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Syria, and Afghanistan, a reflection of the increasing global conflict and war. Resettlement for newcomers and their families is a daunting task as they start their new lives with limited resources and away from the lives they once knew. What with the goal to become a certified welcoming community, how can Cleveland empower the region's growing newcomer population? Joining me on stage today are Tina Coleman, Multi-Systems Coordinator and Outreach Supervisor at Cuyahoga County Health and Human Services, Patrick Kearns, Executive Director at Resource Cleveland, previously known as Refugee Response, Aziza Salukombo, Vice President of the Cleveland Congolese Youth Community, and Pastor Luis Vizcarondo, Senior Pastor at Refine Church. If you have a question for our panelists, you can text it to 330-541-5794, and the City Club staff will try to work it into the second half of the program. Members and friends of the City Club, please join me in welcoming our speakers to the Happy Dog. So thank you all for being here, for our panelists and also for our audience who's making time to join us here today. I want to begin our conversation by sort of setting the context. We heard a little bit in the introduction, sort of a more national, global context, but what I'm really interested in sort of getting your take on is, why do people migrate? And here locally, what are you seeing as the primary drivers for folks that are migrating and landing here in Cleveland? And I would like to start with Pastor Luis. Since you're on the ground doing this work, grassroots, and sort of the front line, sort of the first people that immigrants might interact with.
So one of the biggest things that I'm noticing is there's a huge distrust in government that's occurring across the globe, and it's becoming a lot more difficult for immigrants to place that trust in any other government, right, when they arrive. And another issue is that we're seeing is that they're looking for, you know, work for more well-being for their families, and so they're just trying to find any way they can to bring that support to their families, to their friends, to their neighborhoods. And so, I mean, I will tell you this, that there's not a one size fits all, right, criteria or story. You're always gonna see a unique story to each newcomer that comes to the United States. So I just wanna make that clear. So I can give you a few reasons, but the reasons are continuous. They never end. I mean, there's just so many different reasons, but those are some of the reasons that we're starting to see is like I said, it's just the governments that are becoming a little bit oppositional, corrupt, and not helping their people.
Thank you. Patrick, I wanted to see if there was anything additionally you wanted to add in sort of what you're seeing.
Sure, thanks. It is complicated. Immigration is complicated. I think we understand that. And there's a lot of different terms. There's a lot of different statuses that people have when they arrive or before they arrive, and it's important to understand how that affects people after they arrive. As a young man, I had the opportunity and the good fortune to live and work inside of a refugee camp for 2 years, and that camp has now been there for 40 years. Those are families that grew up, that were born inside of a refugee camp. That is a long-term protracted situation. That's one case. Other cases are some of the folks that Pastor Louise is working with who literally had to pick up their bags and flee and then came across the border and found themselves here in a week. One thing I think is important to understand is that all of these pathways make a difference to how people arrive and how they get forward on their lives from there. I think often about, if you waited so long in a refugee camp to come here, it does something, right? It sets you up for some expectations on what life is and what life should be. And then after you get here, sometimes you realize that it's a really different than the dreams you had. And the reality of a lot of folks we see across the board who are newcomers is the first couple years, they're living in pretty hard poverty. They're struggling. And that's where, I'm very fortunate to have friends like these that we're all here to do this, to meet people at the community level and make sure that they can get beyond that, what we say, that story of being a refugee and try to get back to what is that, what once was normal and what can be normal again for their lives here.
Thank you. And that is just such a great follow-up question. Well, you set that up perfectly for my follow-up question is what I was trying to say. Is, both you and Pastor Luis, also one thing that resonates a lot in what you're saying is this idea of having a safe place or a home, right? People trying to, they're leaving their old home and then trying to settle into a new place and trying to make a home there. So what does it take for refugees and newcomers to be able to find home or create a new home here in Cleveland or Cuyahoga County? And Aziza, I was hoping that maybe you could share a little bit about your lived experience.
I just wanted to add to the question that you asked earlier. If I were to answer that question, I'd like to remind people that it's not always by choice. I think a lot of people have that misconception that we migrate here because it's a choice. And the one thing that you hear mostly is we're here for a better life. And if we had a better life, we would stay where we were. I'm from the Republic of Congo by blood. My shirt says otherwise because I was born in a different country due to my mother fleeing from a situation. So I wore this on purpose today. But to answer your question, I think the resources that are provided for these people, the constant help with people like Resource Cleveland, I still like Refugee Response, by the way. I think just having these great resources when we come here, fortunately for me, or fortunately or unfortunately, I did not have the experiences of the caseworkers and stuff like that because my father was already here. So I came on an asylum refugee status because he was already here. So came in, but even then, with my father being here 5 years in, we had caseworkers that would come to the house and make sure that we were still, acclimating to the country. And it's tough, with the laws, not knowing the laws, not knowing the language, not having, everything is just strange. And having people like all of us to help our own people that don't look like you, people that are not from where you're from, is very helpful to keep that going. So, yeah.
And so one piece of that is what does it take in terms of the individuals that are newcomers and coming here, right? But I'm also hearing a piece around the community. Yeah. And so, my follow-up would be, what does it take from, in terms of the community, what can existing residents and organizations, what role can they play in creating that welcoming, supportive environment? And the first thing I think of is the Welcome Center that we have here in Cuyahoga County. And so I'd love to hear a little bit about that from you, Tina, but also then from, in a broader sense of what have you seen it takes from the side of the community?
Sure. So representing Cuyahoga County, we started the process to become certified welcoming, which is where the Welcome Center really was created from. This was really to make sure that the whole community was a welcoming place for all of our immigrants and our refugees. We really wanted to focus on what's needed from all aspects, whether it is law enforcement, whether it is providing access to resources like public benefits, to connection to housing, whatever the resource need is. It was really all thought through that process of making sure that we are an access point. We wanted to be involved in the work that's happening in the community. And so this Welcome Center really is a place to bring all of the partners together that are doing the work in the community, that are providing the resources from a lens of collaboration. So although many people come to the Welcome Center for public benefits, it's really that access point to help connect them to other resources as well, help them understand that as a county agency, we want to help. Sometimes we have our hands tied due to policies and procedures, but we do the best that we can to make sure that people know how to access what they need, and they know who to go to and what's available. So I think that that's the thing that we've been seeing at the Welcome Center. It's only been open for a little over a month now, but the folks that are coming in to seek services are really being able to walk out feeling as though that they've been helped. The staff that are there are really learning. They're understanding what the needs are. We really are excited about this, but we know that we have to build that trust in the community, and that's really what we have to do in working with the partners.
So maybe to broaden the question a little bit further, is, you know, in terms of accessing those resources, and that often means interfacing with institutions and systems, what are you seeing as the challenges, in terms of being able to become that certified welcoming community?
What I've seen is the challenges is really the capacity in one aspect is everyone has a limit on what they're able to do. So bringing different partners in that are providing services has been a challenge just due to the staffing and the funding for these different resources. I always have contacts that I can call when something is needed. Someone walks through the door with a different need that we just don't have on hand. But I think that having someone on site when someone walks through the door has been the biggest challenge. We've been lucky to have certain partners that really help us navigate this work that are the experts in helping people that are needing to really navigate the community and make this home. Mm-hmm. So I think that the biggest challenge is really just that collaboration work. And we've been making progress. It's been a really a great thing. And I think that it's expected to grow slowly. And I think that, sometimes we want things to happen really quickly, but we know that this work takes time if we're gonna do it the right way.
Pastor Luis, I'd love to hear from you on the same question. When we first met prior to this panel, we had this great conversation, and you mentioned something that has still stuck with me is past is prologue. And I'd love for you to share sort of your take on that and what you were meaning by that, because it was really eye-opening for me.
So one of the challenges I know we've been noticing a lot too is one of them is the resource and intensity, which is a relational approach. You have cultural language barriers and very trust levels, which is one of the biggest ones. And one that I can testify to is that basically we've had where unfortunately people in the community hear the rhetoric, right? Politically, and they say, well, hey, pastor, are you bringing communists into the country? Is that what these people are? And that is not the way to approach things, right? And unfortunately, there's people don't understand the complexity and intricacies that are involved in all of this. And so one of the biggest things is, how can we truly identify right, the diverse needs, and understanding that each person is going to have their own unique case. You know, there's complexities in coordination too. We can't all do it ourselves. And one of the biggest things that we spoke about with Golnar and the rest of the panel here was that we have to be able to establish that relational approach. And that relational approach is not gonna always happen at a government building. It's gonna have to happen with our neighbors. It's gonna have to happen at churches, you know, your local store, wherever it may be. But we need to have that relational aspect in order to start building the trust we can with each and every single individual that we can, so that way we can grow not only the Welcome Center, but truly address the needs on an individual basis as a genuine welcoming community.
Patrick, this one's for you, because it makes me think about this idea of access, right? And in terms of being able to access these resources, these spaces and places where they might be able to get resources and support, what role does the path of getting here play, right? And I say path in quotes, because right now we hear a lot of rhetoric around undocumented or illegal pathways of getting here, but the challenges are significant for folks that are following the right, quote unquote, way of getting here too. So maybe you could share a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. And I think it's first, you know, important to say, a lot of times the language and terminology that we hear in the media is completely bogus and completely unhelpful. Things get lumped into one package of things. We hear about refugees, and that means everybody that comes into the country, or undocumented. The reality is that when we see folks here, they're showing up, and more often than not, they crossed a border, they came in, they have a piece of paper that said, by some means, the US government said, these folks are entering the country. We've had a long-standing policy in this nation of welcoming asylum seekers. You know, I think before 2016, it was never a controversial thing to support refugees and asylum seekers. And that changed, you know, and I spent 15 years overseas and I came back and all of a sudden, like the word refugee all of a sudden has this negative connotation. And I think we've been dealing with that front and center on a reality and of how it affects policy since that time. And the reality is these people are here. We've had families show up with papers, they have a court date, and we really have to look at that path. And when we look at folks who come in from, let's say, from the emergency in Ukraine, you know, I am so glad we were able to welcome all of these families here and provide support. It is also true that our government rolled out policies, the United for Ukraine policy, that allowed people to come in and access benefits and work permits right away. It's also true people that are fleeing situations where they're being persecuted for being LGBT, where they're fleeing the southern border, where they're fleeing gang violence, what are they afforded? Little to nothing. We see, and I know Pastor Louis sees folks every day that they're here, they have a court date, they have a documentation, their kids might be in school, yet they have no ability to get a work authorization, they have to wait. And sometimes that wait period is up to a year. What are we supposed to be doing? What are we doing for this year? These folks are here. So I think it is really incumbent upon us, all of us, and I think this is what Pastor Luis is talking about, is that we can't wait for a one-size-fits-all approach from the federal government, because we'll wait to the end of time, and it's not coming. We have to address what the realities are on immigration, those folks coming in through the resettlement program, that pathway. They have access to certain things, but other folks who are coming in with the short end of a short stick. And what are we doing as a community? What are we doing as faith leaders? What are we doing as nonprofit leaders to make sure that we had a family from Ecuador that was sleeping outside at an RTA stop for four nights, and they crossed a border. They were put on a bus to come here. In what world is that acceptable? In what world is it controversial to provide those folks a safe passageway and the basic means for them to be able to support their kids. What world is that controversial in? And I think it's important that we clarify this message that, you know, as we're working in here at Cuyahoga County, we're working with individuals. And again, to, you know, the points my friends are making up here, every different path, every different story has its unique way of getting here. And there's broad instruments the government has that are one size fits all for certain people, but the reality of the work is much more nuanced, it's much more complicated than that, and it does take the people in this room, it takes these organizations, and it takes a little bit of coordination, even though that's really challenging at times.
Thank you. I want to go think about this also in terms of generationally, right? You mentioned at the beginning that you worked at a refugee camp, and now that camp's been around for 40 years. So there's like multiple generations of families that's all they've known and that's all they've lived with. And it makes me think about the work that you're doing, Aziza, with youth, and particularly in the Congolese community.
Yeah.
What do you see in terms of the impact of that and the lack of, you know, we have some resources, we don't have enough. We never have enough resources for everything anyway, I get that. But, you know, what are sort of the implications in terms of generationally for families? Because these generations that are here, they're also part of our community, and then that has an impact on our community as a whole. Maybe you could share a little bit of what you've experienced or seen in your work.
It's funny because I was just talking to you about this. I guess for me, as a youth leader in the Congolese community, I can only speak on my community because that's what I know. The one thing that I've noticed is like you said, generationally, like the challenges of trying to, I told him, I was like, I feel like I'm trying to infiltrate the adults of our community. Because like being that we were raised here, we go to school here, like majority of my youth now are like, they're basically Americans. Like mm-hmm. their DNA is something else, but mentally, look at me. Like, it's tough trying to get that. It's been tough. Like the best way to describe it is it's been tough trying to get our adult groups to understand that you're here and unfortunately you have to kind of sort of acclimate through what's here as well, and the resources are here for you. You just have to be able to accept the resources. That's another thing that we face a lot is like trying to get our grown-ups to understand like these are here for you. Like you have to just accept them. They may not be enough, like you said, but accepting the resources that are available, I think, is one of the biggest challenges that we face in our community, especially ours, like the Congolese community. It's tough. Like, mm-hmm. it's really tough.
And is there any work being done in terms of making those resources culturally appropriate or acceptable? Like, what's on the flip side of that? And maybe, Tina, you could share a little bit in terms of the Welcome Center and some of the work that's happening there around culturally appropriate resources.
So we have partnerships. So one of them is Resource Cleveland and their Navigator program, which I think really brought a lot of education to us at the county because their navigators are from the different communities that they serve. And so I think that we are taking that information and using the information that they're providing to help build out kind of our resources, but as well connect them to more people that are coming in through the doors that maybe didn't directly go to them. And so it's helping us to really learn and to train staff on what's culturally appropriate, how they should be interacting with people differently as they're coming in to make sure that they feel comfortable and they come back if they need something and they know where to go, and we want people to come back. And so building each of those relationships, and then now I may have a new contact to reach out to if someone walks in and maybe they don't regularly visit us or reach out for resources, but now we know how to help them best, just what's culturally appropriate for their community.
Yeah.
You know, one thing, you know, just to kind of follow up on that, 18 months ago, it was really common to see families waiting long periods of time for their benefits reapplications or not knowing how to go through it or not having that language access. Because kind of to Aziza's point, a lot of the families we work with, they might not know what that phone call is, right? They might not know what that letter is that comes to the mail, and you miss an appointment, right? And then your SNAP card is, you know, out of date. And it was pretty common to see long periods of wait time. In the past couple months, and I think with this partnership with the county, and, you know, really big hats off to this, we've seen that wait time cut from what was 6 months or longer to a period of, you know, 2 to 3 weeks for people to get applications in and get their interviews. I was there one morning where we had a couple families show up that had from the Ukraine. They had been in the county for 4 days. They showed up that morning, and it was a quiet morning, which it usually isn't. They did their application. They got interviewed that day, and they were approved. I mean, that's a four-hour turnaround time. That makes a difference. And to a larger point, you know, it keeps families here. It allows them to access services and be able to stay here in Cleveland and invest in their families. Because if you don't have to worry so much about, you know, that food bill every month, then you can start, you can get that first car, right? You can support a couple more things that are gonna make your life more meaningful here. And I think it's been transformative in a lot of ways.
To pick up on what you just said about it keeps these families here and here in Cleveland, and this one is for all of you. I'd love to start with Pastor Luis and then, you know, follow on down. So it sounds like a lot, right? And there's a lot of work, a lot of investment of resources. It's a lot for the newcomers themselves, but also in terms of the community. What are the benefits? Like, what do we gain as a community by being a welcoming place? And what do we risk losing if we don't make that sort of investment?
Right. So I would say that, you know, for all of us in the community, it's learning how to embrace each other, right? We learn the beauty of different cultures, ethnicities, backgrounds, and learning to truly love one another, right? That's one of my perspectives. And then additionally, we also start to realize the importance that not only is right a physical structure and development in our community great, but if we're developing the people that are coming in, right, and helping them integrate truly into the community, we will see our American cities across the U.S. thrive and grow and become great cities once more.
Knowledge. I am who I am today because I've been around people who are nothing like me, don't think like me. I enjoy being in a room that challenges me to be anything other than what my mind says I am. So I think that's one thing that we gain from having these people, or us, come in. Also, I just want to challenge everyone to think, like, how would you want to be treated if you were seeking refuge anywhere else?
Thank you.
I think I can add, from my perspective, you know, my world is really public benefits and human services, and our goal is to make people become self-sufficient and through providing them with resources like public benefits, like work programs that can help them gain new skills and get connected to education. And I think that's where, you know, providing that kind of bridge to those resources is what's going to help people, because they're coming here temporarily for the supports so that then they can get on their own feet. And now they are the community. They might open a business. They may invest in their community in other ways. And so I think that that's where we are helping for everyone to make this their own community.
Yeah, and I'll say, you know, the jury's been back on this one. $8 to $1, economic impact versus cost. That's what we spend, $1 for every $8 newcomers bring into communities across the U.S. That has been well documented for years upon years. We know it is a source of strength and vitality. We know people come in, they are more likely to start businesses. After they're here, they buy homes, their kids grow up here, and like Aziza, then they go to school and sit on panels like this, which is really cool. And that is development. I mean, this is...
Yes.
This is how this works, right? People get here, they find their feet, they need a little bit of help at first, then they figure it out, then they buy a house, and then they're successful, and then their kids are really awesome, and they do great things. I mean, it's not much more complicated than that, and I think we get confused by the complications around these things when the reality is it's very simple. These are people that want to be here. They want to rewrite the chapter of their lives here. They want to get back to that new normal, and more often than not, I think it's really the parents. The parents are making a bet. They're saying, you know, this was tough. This is going to be good for our kids. And I think by and large, when we can have these support systems in place, it is going to be good for those kids. And that's good for all of us.
Thank you. I think that we have time for one more question, and I would want to end on this, and that's because I can't ignore it. We are in an election year, and there's a lot of issues on the docket and a lot of conversation happening around policy, and I think, you know, as people make choices and decisions, I just want to hear from each of you sort of from your perspective, what is at stake for immigrants and newcomers and refugees in terms of the policies that could impact us moving forward and our future generations that are also here trying to have a home? Ziza, would you like to start, and then we can let's switch it up. Let's hear from.
So, I would say personally, I have a background actually where I worked in the federal government in Homeland Security. So I'm on the other end now, right? helping immigrants, and one of the biggest things is understanding the humanity aspect, right? That we need to have that humanity when helping each and every single one of these immigrants coming in. I know that I've seen it personally as a pastor also helping a lot of these immigrant families that we've kind of lost touch in today's society because of all the politics, and we haven't realized the importance our voice has in the community and our vote, right? So, you know, we gotta look out for one another. And I say this because, me being a Latino myself, I've seen the rhetoric that has been said of people being vermins and all this other stuff, and it's hurtful as a Latino, especially when you're seeing other Latinos being tossed around and thrown these words at. You know, you start to worry because it's like, what's gonna happen to our people and the rest of the immigrants coming in? Well, what are we gonna do, right? And so I think we have to get back to where there's a reality, right, that needs to happen in our minds, that humanity is where it's at. We have to have our voices heard, and we have to make sure that, you know, we're doing the right things for everyone and for society's sake.
I guess what I would say is at stake is, I cannot tell you how to vote, but vote. but I believe what's at stake is for, you know, this population or this group of people, what's at stake for them is people making decisions who do not, like people making decisions for them who do not understand how their lives work. Something that you said very important yesterday, Patrick, was that refugees are not a monolith. And a lot of times people making these decisions are thinking that things are this way or that way. Mm-hmm. So that's what's at stake for me is, you know, people are sitting in these offices thinking that this is how this works, but it doesn't. It's like, there's different ways. So do your research, learn who you're voting for, understand their ideologies. Are they doing the research that they need to do what they have to do too? So just do the research and vote.
Thank you.
So I mentioned it earlier, the policies and procedures. You know, these policies, these procedures, they come from the federal government, they come from the state. And so being in a county office, having to determine eligibility for these supportive programs, and having our hands tied sometimes is very challenging. One person walks in and they may be eligible for something, the next person walks in and they're not, just because of their class of admission that they had when they came into the country. So the voting and all of the politics are really important when it comes to the county being able to provide certain services. We don't have the flexibility that we wish we could have sometimes that would allow us to make sure that people are able to eat or able to go to the doctor. And so that's where it really plays a big part in all of the politics for us, because it really does come down to what policies have been implemented and what we have to follow.
There's an election this year? Is that?
I know, right?
Yeah, I hadn't heard anything about it. There's no news coverage of that at all, isn't there? I'm joking. There's a lot at stake in this election. We have folks that are on temporary protected status and on humanitarian parole. Those are temporary statuses, right? Those are all of our Afghan folks, all of our Ukrainian folks. That can be overturned by administration decision. So that is a status that could be changed. Those folks do not have a pathway to long-term citizenship. I think it also is a big question of what is the future of asylum in the U.S.? What is the future of birthright citizenship in the U.S.? I think it's important to understand that a change in administration will affect the lives of people that we know, that we work with, that we see every day, that are our neighbors. It will dramatically affect their lives. And it could happen in a pretty quick period of time. After the 2016 election, we saw very swift changes in the refugee resettlement policy. I think we should expect to see those things amplified considerably. I think we should be aware for, you know, what is gonna happen a little bit later after a potential new administration that could look at moving people out of the country on those temporary statuses. What would that do for kids that were born here? I think it could get very complicated. I'm hopeful that we could all band together and be sensible and humane about things. I am concerned, though, that a change in administration and a change in policy will have deep and lasting effects on who we are as a nation, who we are as a people, and how we welcome folks.
Thank you. Thank you to all the panelists for the enlightening discussion and insight. We are about to begin the audience Q&A. For our live stream audience or those just joining us, I'm Gulnar Farasta, Managing Director of the LGBT Community Center of Greater Cleveland and moderator for today's forum. Joining me on stage are Tina Coleman, Multi-Systems Coordinator and Outreach Supervisor at Cuyahoga County Health and Human Services, Patrick Kearns, Executive Director at Resource Cleveland, previously known as Refugee Response, Aziza Salukombo, Vice President of the Cleveland Congolese Youth Community, and Pastor Luis Vizcarondo, Senior Pastor at Refined Church. If you are here with us in person, you can line up next to the microphone to my left to ask your question. If you are joining us virtually or prefer to text in your question, you can text it to 330-541-5794. City Club staff will try to work them in. May we have the first question, please?
Yes, to the panel, please discuss the commonalities that immigrants and refugees share, and in what ways is the experience different?
Who would like to take that question?
I'll jump in. I think what's shared is, I'm gonna steal one thing Aziza said before, and especially tonight we're talking about, let's say, forcibly displaced people, right? We're not talking about people that are coming in on work visas, all right? Just to set the terms of the conversation. What I think is a commonality is that more, almost exclusively, this is not a choice people are making. I think back to the war in Syria, and when people were leaving Syria, and they were getting on rafts across the Mediterranean Ocean, and there was this great long-form journalist piece that followed these families and looked at how they were manipulated and taken advantage of during this path. And you could see these rafts that are filled with 150, 200 people, you know, children included. And, you know, I always think about what would it take you to get yourself on that raft, and what would it take you to get your kids on that raft? And the answer is not, I think they have better health care in Cleveland, or that's not the answer. The answer is you have to. I worked in an area that people had to leave because their homes and their villages are literally no longer there. They're gone. There was airstrikes. It's not a choice. It is a forcible displacement. That is a commonality. And the differences, I mean, we could spend a lot of time talking about the differences. I think we mentioned some. The differences in what people are eligible for when they arrive. Again, our federal programs are blunt instruments. It's as much as possible, one size fits all, where we know that in certain countries where people came from, the conflict displaced the parents when they were children, meaning that the parents never had the opportunity to go to school. Whereas if we look at Ukraine, that was a recent displacement where folks, the adults mostly had access to technology and education. You know, so those are some of the different nuances of the stories of people when they arrive. And, you know, because our federal systems are blunt instruments, we all have to be those scalpels, right? Those really surgical devices that understand these particular communities and understand, you know, what they need in order to make this adjustment possible.
One of the things is, too, you know, kind of piggybacking off of Patrick here, is that we look at a general broad topic, right? And I'm talking from my experience, not only as a pastor, but also formerly Homeland Security. You have conflict, persecution, and economic hardship, right? Three very broad categories. And, you know, that one size fits all category with the government is like, well, this is what people have to meet, right, in order to qualify for something. Now, one of the main issues that I used to see personally, especially somebody who, not proud of this, but I used to be a part of a deportation team. So one of the things was that when you hear the stories and you listen intently, you start to realize that although there is a general term, right, that covers that specific case, the uniqueness of that case brings out the true, genuine colors of what is going on. And right now, as a pastor, one of the first cases I encountered, right, was that we have an individual who came from Nicaragua. And Nicaragua right now is under a dictatorship. And it's very difficult to hear his story because he became a part of the opposition of the government, right, against the government. And even if he was to run off to Costa Rica, Nicaragua actually has different agreements with some of these countries. And the government is willing, these other governments are willing to turn them over so that same person that's in government can kill them. And so he wished he could be reunited with his mom, dad, everybody. But unfortunately, that's not the case. So that's what Patrick and all of us here are trying to get to, is that when we hear these cases, none of them are going to be the same. Even though we hear conflict, persecution, or economic hardship, we also have to sit there and listen to these cases.
Yeah, we do. There's a bunch of questions coming in through text. And also, don't be shy if you're sending them in through text. Feel free to come on up to the microphone. And we're getting a few in. And I know, I think one of you guys are here. I guarantee it. Like, come on up, guys. So our next text question, we're going to take in a little bit of a different direction. We are seeing increased refugees from countries grappling with war and conflict. But what is Cleveland doing to prepare for an increase of climate crisis refugees?
Anybody want to tackle that?
Patrick? let's just say not enough. How about that? We're not quite doing enough. I mean, our location is pristine. We have places, we have work, we have places for people to move or build houses.
We have water.
Exactly.
Lakes.
We have water, we have lakes. I don't think it has been, from my understanding, as far as organizations working on the ground with folks arriving, we have yet to see that particular cause be a main factor in people arriving here. I think it is a precipitating cause in many situations. I think there are a lot of issues around climate that lead to land confiscation issues, that lead to persecution and forcible displacement. But in terms of, like, let's say, quote unquote, a environment refugee, to my knowledge, we don't have a specific program that recognizes people under that category.
That was a great question.
Yeah.
Sounds like we need like a work group.
Yeah, a little more work. We need, yeah.
I feel like Cleveland needs to be, yeah. I just completely jump. I know that Councilman McCormick and our series at Public Square had mentioned Cleveland being a climate crisis city and the work that's going. So that's pretty interesting. The next text question is coming in. It says, most nonprofit websites are only available in English. How can we encourage nonprofits to hire bilingual staff and to translate their websites so that their content and programs are accessible to people with limited English proficiency?
I don't know many organizations, but I do interpret for a lot of different, you know, places around the area. And I do know that a lot of places are taking the initiative to hire people like me, where if like they have a big event that requires something like that, they'll bring in someone to interpret. I was thinking about the day we were interpreting there's so many different versions of Swahili, and it's like a lot of the organizations that I know anyway, the ones that I work with, I know that they're taking the initiative to, yes, the website is in that language, or they can try to interpret it. And I won't lie to you guys, interpretation will never be perfect. Like, the different dialects of all the languages that we speak, I speak 7 different languages, and they all have different dialects in them. So it's rough to try to, like, please every single one with all the websites, but I do know that the organizations that I have worked with, the organizations that have helped me, they make sure that they have someone there that can at least translate something if needed. So at least... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think if you're a small organization, it's challenging because at times there's about 128 different languages that you could be faced with. I think the county does a good job at having a call-in service. We try to cover as many languages as we can, but we also have to ask a practical question. Is the website the thing that clients are accessing?
Yeah.
Is it really? Or is it the phone call they get? Is it the ability to know somebody at an organization who can answer their questions that's more valuable? So, I would say, when it is a matter of completing something and filling something out, of course it needs to be accessible on a website or online to fill out. While we also understand that a lot of the clients we work with might not be literate in their home language because they were forcibly displaced when they were a child and never had the opportunity to go to a primary school. So there is not an easy, again, with this, there's not an easy one-size-fits-answer. Say, oh, yeah, we got this in this language done. That's all we have to do. I think it's actually a better approach to say, we're going to focus on hiring people in the organization that do that interaction with families so you have somebody to talk to. Mm-hmm. Not rely on, clients being digitally literate as well as literate in a particular language to access services. I actually think that could be a false way of presenting accessibility it's actually putting up more barriers and might not be solving the problem. I will say, though, in our recent times, the one language that has done tremendously well with Translate is Ukrainian. Google Translate is tremendous for Ukrainian, I think a lot because of, how we have invested in defense services over in Ukraine, but that is not across all of the language groups whatsoever.
All right, another text question. Please don't be shy. What is helping fund the Welcome Center? It seems like such a no-brainer idea. What made this center possible, and what challenges did the county need to overcome for it to happen now?
Great question. So the Welcome Center, really, it does have limited funding. It's using the resources that we have had within staffing. It's using the collaborations, as I've mentioned earlier. There are funds that are being allocated to this Welcome Center really to make sure that we are increasing access with language. As Patrick mentioned, using the interpretation services, using these translation services to make sure that when someone walks through the door, that they can be helped. We have used that because although we have some staff that are bilingual, we don't have a lot of staff that are bilingual. And so we have to use those resources and put that money towards having these contracts and having these sources. I think that as we continue to grow this Welcome Center, there's gonna be more funding that we have to seek out. There's going to be those things that we find are completely necessary in making sure that this Welcome Center is successful, and it is going to take funding. But right now, as we're growing it and seeing what the needs really are, we're able to take note of that. We're able to do the research and work with our different partners so that we can really have an intentional effort of kind of putting the money where our mouths are and making sure that we're doing what we need to do as the county government, because we have to build that trust, as everyone knows. But we also know that we also have to bring in the partnerships as well for those until we build that trust. That's really what's necessary. So there's never enough money, but we're doing what we can.
All right, this one is coming actually from my kids, who are being very shy all of a sudden, who don't want to come to the microphone, which I feel like a few people also same. How can kids help their friends who are refugees?
Oh, I love that.
So I would like to say one thing. A couple weeks ago, we had a group of middle schoolers come and visit the Welcome Center. These middle schoolers are learning about the experience of our refugee communities really coming here, and what are they experiencing when they're coming to Cleveland. So they did kind of like a special project, and so they recently asked me, what can they contribute, the children, what can they contribute to the Welcome Center so that teenagers and children can get acclimated and feel like this is their community. So I think that kids can really look at what do they like to do, what are the things that they enjoy, and what would help them feel like, oh, I can make friends, I can participate in things, and then sharing that information with the grown-ups so that, you know, it can be relayed to someone in the community that can provide a resource. So the kids at this high school are going to be developing kind of a resource guide that we can take a look at and make sure that it's shared throughout the community with all of the folks that might be interested.
Oh, I would just say, talk to them. I remember when I first came here, I came to America, I think I was in eighth grade for a few months. So I was a child, but I remember the one thing that helped me, like, want to push myself to, one, learn the language, two, just, like, be comfortable, was kids just coming up to me and saying random things to me. I tell this story every single time. So when we were in Uganda, they speak English. So I knew, how are you? That was about it, right? Some girl came up to me and she was like, what's up? I thought she was being mean to me. Like, I had never heard anybody greet anybody that way. But ever since that day, like, I just say talk to them. And, like, working in schools for 4 years, and us being in the schools, like, for the interpretation purposes, like, the kids tend to, like, gravitate towards us because it's someone that's similar to you. So just approach them. Challenge them, you know, be friendly. Don't look at them as anything other than you. Just, like, approach them, even if it seems uncomfortable for them. I'm big on, like, pushing me out of my comfort zone. So maybe uncomfortable, but they will appreciate it in the end. And maybe that's just the tough love side of my Congolese side, but I don't know. We need to work on that.
So last call for questions. And with that, I just want to say thank you once again to Tina, Patrick, Aziza, and Pastor Luis for joining us here today at the Happy Dog. Forums like this one are made possible thanks to generous support from individuals like you. You can learn more about how to become a guardian of free speech and make a donation today at cityclub.org. Tonight's forum is also part of the City Club in the Community series sponsored by Bank of America. And thank you to the members and friends of the City Club, both here and streaming live. I'm Gulnar Farasta, and this forum is now adjourned. I love that song.